Welcome everybody, and this week we get to enjoy the snazzy new projector and screen from the Buddhist Society, so thank you for the Buddhist Society for providing these. And no doubt you're all thinking to yourselves, hang on, this is number four, isn't it? Yes, it's number four, I got it wrong. Let's move on. Okay. So for this week's, or this month's course rather, we're going to be talking about and presenting Buddhist, early Buddhist meditation. And of course this is one of the core topics, and in fact for many people Buddhism virtually is meditation. And I guess one of the interesting features in the development of Buddhism in the modern era is that while for traditional Buddhism, meditation, for most Buddhists in most of history, meditation has been a marginal thing, if not completely unknown, whereas in the modern era it has become essentially synonymous with Buddhism, really. So I think that there is a kind of a valid point to be made that in modern presentations of Buddhism, sometimes meditation is sort of abstracted, stripped out of its context, presented as if it's a kind of just a technique of attention or something like that. Whereas in fact, in the Buddha's teachings, as we find them, the practice of meditation is always something that happens within a context, and it's that context that really gives it a meaning. So for today's presentation, we'll have a look a bit at the context of meditation, the meaning of meditation, and how it's presented in the early suttas. So this week I'll be presenting the morning session, and Ajahn Brahmali will be doing the afternoon. Okay, so just before I get on with the slides, I might just wait. Still one or two people coming in. Oh, and happy Waisak, everybody. Yeah. Of course, the real meaning or point of Waisak is that, of course, the Buddha's awakening, and the fact that, well, he did that after meditating, didn't he? Yeah, so we should try to understand what it is that he was doing, and of course the crucial moment in that process in the Buddha's life, after he'd spent 6 years of useless effort, the key moment that put him on the path was when he realized all this self-mortification, all of these things I've been doing is a waste of time, and then he recollected the time when he'd been sitting under the jambu tree as a child, and he thought, he'd gone into the first jhana. And then he thought, well, maybe that could be the way to enlightenment. And then this insight came to him that is the path to enlightenment. Eso va maggo bodhaya. To me, that's a very interesting point in the Buddhist scriptures, because that essential truth came to him just as an insight, just as an understanding. At that moment, as soon as he turned his mind to that, suddenly it came to him, this must be the way to enlightenment. So for the early Buddhist teachings on meditation, the practice of jhana is, of course, completely central, and was the key insight that led to the Buddha's awakening. So what we're going to look at for today, I know that you've all probably heard Ajahn Brahm's teachings on meditation and so on many times. And so what we're going to try to do is to look at what are some of the underpinnings of these teachings and approaches to meditation, which you often hear Ajahn Brahm and other people teaching. Where do these things come from in the suttas themselves? When I was preparing the slideshow for this workshop, as usual, I thought I'll throw in a few pictures, and I used the extensive and careful research methodology of Googling early Buddhist meditation and picked a few images that came up. So all the images are the ones that Google thinks is about early Buddhist meditation. And this particular one that I had for the sort of beginning image, I like this one because it has the pool in the background. And this is an image which you find constantly throughout the suttas when the Buddha's talking about meditation, the similes for jhanas, and many different ways the Buddha talks about the mind as being like water. Overcoming the five hindrances is like purifying water in different ways. And the clarity and the stillness of mind is always compared to like a still forest pool and these kinds of imagery. Okay, so before we get going properly, just remind everybody, please switch off your mobile phones. Anybody have a mobile phone? Switch it off now. You know, we're at a pivotal point in human history where from now until the end of time or the collapse of civilization, every group meditation will be interrupted by a mobile phone. Right? There will be not a time when two people can sit together in meditation and not be interrupted by a mobile phone. That age is gone. Right? Unless we make it our choice to switch them all off. And if that doesn't work, more drastic measures will have to be taken. You know, when I teach meditation retreats, I usually have three essential pieces of equipment. One is a teddy bear, and I see now they have the teddy bear at Jhana Grove, so that's good. So the teddy bear's there to make everything all right when you feel really... when everything's bad, then you can just look at the teddy bear and everything's all right. And then duct tape for people who have difficulty keeping the silence. Yeah. And a hammer for people who can't find the off switch on the mobile phone. Yeah. The universal off switch is very effective. Yeah. All right, so moving along. So what I thought we might start out with, we're talking about meditation. Of course, meditation is not a word that the Buddha himself used. We'll come in a few minutes to look at the words that we actually find in the early Buddhist text to talk about meditation. But first, we started out this course by looking at something about the history of Buddhism, how Buddhism was conveyed to the West and to our modern time, and understanding that the prism through which we see the Buddha's teachings is not a neutral one. We don't just receive this kind of abstract teaching in some way. We receive a teaching which is filtered and processed through the forces of history. And so when the word meditation really came from when the early generation of Indologists found these practices and words and so on in the Pali, mainly in the Pali scriptures, and then they had to find some word to equate with it. But of course there really wasn't a single word in the Western tradition which neatly corresponded to what we call meditation. Possibly the closest actually would be contemplation. These days we tend to use the word contemplation to mean sort of reflectively thinking about something. But my understanding is that in traditional like sort of Christian contemplative writings that contemplation actually means something much closer to what we do today as meditation, whereas meditation, in fact, means reflective thinking about something. Anyway, so here's a etymology of the word meditation. So from around 1200, we find it in the meaning of contemplation, devout preoccupation, devotions, prayer, reflection, study, thinking over. Originally derived from the primitive Indo-European, that means it has the same linguistic basis as Pali and Sanskrit and so on, but the root there is from med, which means to measure, limit, advise, take appropriate measures. Interestingly enough, one of the most common words we use in Pali to describe meditation is appamana, which means literally without measure. Yeah, for the four Brahma Viharas are always described as being appamana. So the root in English is to measure, and in Pali is without measure. So that just goes to show that you can't really trust etymology. But anyway, the main point here is that the older meaning of meditation in English or European languages was more about a reflective process of thinking about something, and we find this in older works. But the modern meaning has really changed under Buddhist influence. So this is just from the Wikipedia entry on meditation, and I thought this was good enough. Meditation is a practice in which an individual trains the mind or induces a mode of consciousness either to realize some benefit or as an end in itself. So, I mean, we could quibble about the definition, but that seemed to be a reasonable enough description of what we're doing. So it's specifically a religious or spiritual practice. It's about what an individual does, and I think that's quite an important point, rather than many religious practices are about sort of communal things, you know, joining together in a ritual or something. And it's about training the mind. It's a very Buddhist idea, training the mind, inducing a mode of consciousness. Yeah. So the idea is that we're changing. It's not just using the mind to reflect about something, but it's actually changing how the mind is. And I think this is also very important. And obviously there's some benefit out of that. Okay, so that's basically the Western background of what meditation is. So how did the Buddha talk about meditation? So we don't find necessarily one word that exactly corresponds to what we call meditation today, but there's a range of terms that we find in the early scriptures. Perhaps the word citta bhavana might be the closest to modern meditation, certainly used as a translation for meditation these days, citta bhavana, the development of the mind, although citta bhavana actually is very similar in meaning to samadhi. Yeah, samadhi bhavana and citta bhavana are more or less synonyms in the suttas. So citta bhavana, the citta just means mind, right? And citta is used in all kinds of contexts to mean the mind in any kind of way, right? So it means thought or emotion and these kinds of things. So it's a very broad word. But when we find it in specifically in meditation contexts, it's used in a way which is pretty much the same as samadhi. So it pretty much means awareness or purified awareness. So the development, citta bhavana, development of the mind, doesn't mean development of your ability to think. It doesn't mean development of your emotional intelligence or these kinds of things. Essentially what it means is development of a purified awareness. That's basically what it means. The word bhavana literally means making more of, right? So it's from the root bhu, it's a causative form. So it means to make be more. And I think this is actually a very important point in meditation, when you meditate, that everything becomes amplified, right? So when you sit down to meditate, that your the itches on your skin suddenly become so overwhelmingly important, and every thought that you have becomes like this, and every feeling that you have, everything becomes vivid, right? And this is that bhavana, this is making more. Everything that you're feeling, every feeling that you're having, every thought that you're having, every memory that you're having, becomes more, yeah? It becomes bigger. And so often our meditators will perceive this as being a problem, right? oh, I'm having so many thoughts, I'm having so many memories and so on. Actually, it's not a problem in itself. It's just that's what the mind is like. The mind is becoming more apparent to you. You're becoming aware of what the mind is doing. And so this is that process of citta bhavana. Gradually, as you become more aware of it, then you let go of the less important things and the awareness of the mind becomes more prominent. So I'm just going to briefly run over some of these other terms here to get basic familiarity with some of the meditation vocabulary. We're going to be talking about these terms later on. So citta bhavana, samadhi, oneness, stillness. Perhaps I think the English word that is most precise is coalescence. I'm not sure if we can actually use that as a translation of samadhi. I'm not sure if it's a usable word, but I think that's probably the closest that English comes to actually capturing the meaning of it. It's basically where everything comes together as one. It's always defined in the suttas as being equivalent to unification of mind, cittasya ekagata, and it's also defined as being the four jhanas. Jhana meaning absorption, the word jhana essentially being almost a synonym for meditation in the early suttas, sometimes translated as meditation, although properly jhana really is a state of consciousness which is arrived at through the process of meditation. The root of jhana ultimately is the root dhi, is a Vedic root. And the Vedic root of jhana is very interesting. It's used in the Rig Veda, which is maybe 1,000 years before the Buddha. And what it means, and it's used in a very specific and very important sense there. For the Vedic poets or the Vedic culture, these verses which are being uttered are not just, it's not just poetry that they're composing, but it's much more like channeling, actually. It's like they go into like a trance or some kind of altered state of consciousness, and they're filled with the God. And the God comes to them and speaks to them the words which embody the divinity. And this is what is regarded as being the Vedic words. And that state of inspired and illumined consciousness through which the divinity is channeled into words is dhi. Okay? That's what dhi is. So dhi is that state of inspiration that allows the divinity to be expressed in words. So that's the root where the word jhana comes from. And so we can see even 1,000 years before the Buddha, it has this kind of connotation of being an elevated state of mind. It has a connotation of being associated with light. It's very closely associated in the Vedas with the rising sun in the Gayatri Mantra. So the Gayatri Mantra speaks of that glorious rising sun whose divine radiance impels our dhi, our awareness towards greater consciousness. So this word dhi is like a state of heightened consciousness characterized by brightness and clarity and inspiration. So this is kind of the root where the idea of jhana comes from. And for the Buddha, jhana is always used in a sense of like the four jhanas, four specific states of profound absorption in meditation. Then we have samatha. Again, very similar in meaning, but samatha meaning tranquility, peacefulness of mind. Vipassana, you'd usually find vipassana referred to as insight, although I think perhaps discernment is a better translation. Anupassana, contemplation or sustained observation. Okay, so anu means to along with, passana is to look, so anupassana is a sustained observing of something. And last one, the Satipatthana, which often is translated as the foundations of mindfulness, sometimes as the establishments of mindfulness. And here I've suggested presence of mindfulness. So the word here is Sati and Upatthana, literally is establishment of mindfulness. Interestingly, though, I'm more and more leaning towards translating Satipatthana simply as meditation. Actually, if you look at how the word Satipatthana is used in the suttas, it's pretty much used in a way of what we mean today when we say meditation. So, you know, here a monk gone to the forest, gone to the root of a tree, gone to an empty place, sits down cross-legged, sets his body erect, and as the Pali phrase says, Satipatthana, having established mindfulness, he breathes in and breathes out mindfully. So really, you, in that context, you'd say he sits down and starts meditating, right? That's really what it means. Okay, so just briefly, why do we want to meditate? Okay, people these days, we have many different reasons why we want to meditate. Some people, we meditate to relax. We want to meditate, become more loving people, or not people, as the case may be. Or we meditate to see the God within. So this is more from theistic religions. They have this idea that by meditating, then you can gain contact with the divinity. It's a Brahmanical idea of the thou art that, tadvangasi. Some people like to meditate to gain special powers. Right? Who knows about Lobsang Rampa? I've read Lobsang Rampa's books in Santi Monastery when I first went there. That must have been Aya's books that she left there, huh? Lobsang Rampa is made of awesome. If you haven't not familiar with him, he was this extremely eccentric Englishman, I think in the 50s, who sort of said he was an ex-monk from Tibet and gave these books about all his completely and utterly outrageous adventures that he had in Tibet and so on. And because at those days nobody really knew about Tibet or Buddhism or anything like that, so they didn't know any better. But he was really switched on, you know, and his stories, his books as they went on got more and more outrageous. You know, it started about just, you know, traveling around Tibet and these very psychic powers and stuff, but it ended up like being taken up into the cosmos and traveling to the civilization at the center of the galaxy and all of these kinds of things, yeah. And one time his publisher got suspicious about whether he'd genuinely been a monk in Tibet, so his publisher learnt to say a good morning in Tibetan. And when Lobsang Rampa came to the publisher's office, he said to him, good morning in Tibetan. And he just froze and then collapsed in a faint on the floor, right? And then afterwards, the publisher said, you know, he got back and so on, and then he said the story, the story was that after he'd been a monk in Tibet, he'd been taken and he'd become a spy for the Japanese in the Second World War, and then he'd gone through all of these conditioning programs and so on, and then after that he'd been put into this secret program, and they'd had to program him to immediately collapse if he heard any of the Asian languages, which he'd learnt while he was a spy, right? So this is one reason some people like to meditate, to get some kind of psychic powers, third eye, predicting next week's lottery numbers, whatever. Actualize our spiritual energies. Yeah? So again, from a yogic perspective or something, you have this idea of kundalini and chakras and so on. But this is something which is very much a very real experience for anybody who practices meditation. That you know, when you meditate, you feel more energetic and you feel your energies are becoming more purified, more powerful, and so on. By the way, if anyone's sitting on the floor, you must please come up to the front and sit here. We left space at the front for people to sit on the floor. We last week some people said that there wasn't enough room at the front for people to sit, so you're most welcome to come here. Okay, meditate so it can be really, really peaceful. Yes? You remember him? The Buddha boy? Yeah? He's awesome. He sat under this tree for how long? 9 months or something like that? Can anyone remember how long he was there for? This was a kind of a sensation about 2 or 3 years ago. Right. I think he wimped out before the 6 years were up, didn't he? Yeah. Yeah, and he sat for like 9 months or something. It's nothing. Yeah. But I think the... they all got to be a bit of a circus, you know, everyone sort of gathering around and sort of, you know, stalls selling curry and stuff like that, and it all got to be a bit much, so he moved. But yeah, he just sat there under the tree and all these people came, like I think Discovery Channel and all these people came and did these documentaries and they sort of filmed him continuously for days at a time and so on. It was a really good. I saw the documentary, and it was really funny because you had the, you know, on the one hand, these guys from the Discovery Channel who like got the camera on him for days at a time, and it's interspersed with shots of this doctor who's explaining, no, it's completely impossible. Nobody can sit like this. It can't be real, and obviously was. Anyway, so I'm not sure what's happened to him now. He's probably off meditating somewhere. And of course, the other reason to meditate, to be free. And this is really what the goal of Buddhism is, to be, is freedom. Freedom from suffering, freedom from defilements, freedom from birth, aging and death. So always remember that the Buddha said that just like the ocean, wherever you take the ocean from, it's always salty. Yeah? In the same way, it always has. Whenever you take anything from the Dhamma, wherever you take it from the Dhamma, it always has that flavor of freedom. So when we meditate, don't think of it's not like a sort of we shouldn't be attached to the meditation method or the particular ideas of what we're doing, and we shouldn't be thinking, you know, we have to do it like this or do it like that. The whole point of it is to be free. And so if your meditation is sort of constrained by too much dogma, too much ideology, too much, it has to be in this posture or at this time or this way, and this meditation is right and that meditation, well, that's not freedom. Actually, meditation is a very open thing. And yes, there are certain principles and guidelines which the Buddha taught and which have been shown by experience to be very useful to help with meditation. But we should remember that those things, they're just there to help. They're just there to support. I was discussing this with Ajahn Brahmali the other day. We have this word in Pali called aramana. Okay? And in contemporary meditation and in 20th century meditation circles, aramana means the object of meditation. Right? So he's like, I'm in here and my meditation object is out there, and that's my aramana. It's a very kind of strange way of thinking about meditation. The more I think about it, the more weird it is. You're here, the meditation's there, and somehow I've got to make myself pay attention to that, and then I'm going to get enlightened somehow because of that. I think it's very weird. But the word aramana actually means a support. Right? It's a help. Yeah. So there's one of the verses in the Sutta Nipata where the Buddha's asked, you know, can you give me an aramana? Can you give me something to help me to cross over the flood? Yeah. So this is, think of the meditation object. It's not something which is sort of out there, and it's not something which sort of you have to sort of pay attention to, and that's going to somehow magically make you enlightened. But the meditation object is something to help you, something to support you, like a ground that will help you to walk and cross the flood. And so don't get trapped by meditations. Okay, so I might just stop there for a moment and we can do our first meditation for the next 10 minutes or so. Okay, so moving along. Sorry, could you repeat that? So the question there was, is aramana a synonym of kamatana? Kamatana is not a word you find in early Buddhism at all. So kamatana literally means a workplace. Right? That's what kamatana means. So for the early Buddhism, I don't think we think of meditation as work in early Buddhism. I think that's probably a mistake right there. So this is a commentarial kind of language. Generally speaking, though, in the commentarial usage, then, kamatana and aramana are more or less synonyms. They basically just mean what is your meditation subject or meditation object. Yeah, but aramana is never used in that sense in the early Buddhism at all. Yeah. It's neither... Kamatana is not found at all. Aramana is not found in that meaning. Yeah. Aramana just means a support or a help. Gave who, sorry? Oh, yeah, that's all commentarial stories. No. I mean, obviously there are different kinds of meditation, right? It's just how we talk about them. That's the thing. They're not talked about as meditation objects in a sense. Yeah, it's just a different way of doing it. It's more like how should we pay attention, or what kind of perception should we develop? That's the kind of language that the Buddha used to talk about meditation in the suttas. You know, develop the perception of impermanence, and then when you do that, then that will have such an effect. It will help you to let go of that sense of self or sense of attachment. Yeah, but it wasn't like take impermanence as your meditation object. Right? Once you start using that language, then it becomes like the meditation becomes a thing in itself, and that thing has its own effects. Whereas if you say, well, develop the perception of impermanence, it's reminding you that it's all about the subject. It's all about how you see things. Yeah? So you can develop your perception, change the way that you see things, rather than being this objective idea that this thing is going to make you enlightened or whatever. You see that difference? It's just a different way of thinking about meditation, different way of talking about it, which I think makes quite a difference in actually how we approach things. We shouldn't sort of neglect these things. The Buddha was extremely precise in the way that he formulated things. And one of the eternally rewarding things about studying the early Buddha's teachings is that you constantly come back to things that you maybe have read or seen a long time ago, and then you sort of struck freshly by how right that is. It's just put just the right way, that the phrasing of it. Okay, it's not just a peculiarity. There's actually a careful reason why things are described in that way. And so this is one of those things that we've seen as a tendency in the later tradition, is to put much more emphasis on the object of meditation rather than seeing meditation as a subjective process. And so we'll be looking at these a little bit later in the day. Again, some of the differences between how Buddhism's taught in early Buddhist texts and how we find it often taught in 20th century meditation. It's important to know these things because you will inevitably pick up meditation books or listen to Dhamma talks and so on and so forth by many different teachers. And as a meditation teacher, this is something I get asked all the time. You know, so-and-so says this and so-and-so says that, and how do we reconcile this and that and so on. So it's very important that if you understand, well, where are the early suttas coming from, then you'll know how to understand and put in context all of these different teachers and understand why they approach meditation in these different ways. Oh, yeah. Sorry? how the word kamatana came about, I'm not really sure, actually. I've never researched that particular point. I don't know. Venerable, do you know anything about that? Maybe occurs in the suttas, but nothing to do with meditation. Yeah. What's the meaning in the suttas? Yeah. Maybe. Okay, so maybe it does occur in the suttas, but not to do with meditation. Look, what you can usually find with these things is you can sort of trace a particular usage and sort of identify when it first gets used in that way. But I haven't done that with this particular term. It certainly is very common in the commentaries. Whether it appears earlier than the commentaries, I'm not sure. Yeah. Okay, so... Kama means workplace. Kama means work. Tana means place. okay, so the process of meditation. This is another thing that's very important to remember about meditation, is that meditation is a flow. And even though sometimes we talk about like states of consciousness and so on as being kind of relatively static things, but the meditation itself is a flow. It's a change, and it has a meaning within that context. So, from a Buddhist point of view, ultimately the context is enlightenment or liberation. That's what the goal of Buddha's practice is. Within the process of meditation as a whole. The goal, the goal doesn't have to be enlightenment. Okay, many people meditate for different reasons, but if we are practicing within that Buddhist context, one of the beautiful things about this is that the little things that we do, all of those tiny little acts and choices that we make, these are all contributing. These are all part of that flow. Sometimes we find that. People present Buddhism as if there's a kind of a dichotomy between, say, the lifestyle, which is the ultimate purpose of Buddhism is to become enlightened and escape from samsara, and then that's kind of contrasted with a kind of a worldly gain of, being happy and content in this life or going to heaven or something like that. And these are regarded as being sort of an ultimate path and a lesser path. But I think that's a misunderstanding. I think that all of these things are actually part of the same path, but just to lesser degrees, greater or lesser degrees. So there's no there shouldn't be a dichotomy between practicing ethics, between practicing generosity, and doing all of those little things, and then those higher dhammas of meditation. And this is something which is very beautiful and which we find throughout all of the suttas, is that those people who have attained to those very profound dhammas are also people with very very highly developed and very, very solid ethics and so on. This is something which is sometimes referred to in modern psychology as spiritual bypassing. Okay, this is kind of the problem that they have, is that people, when they come to Buddhism, often want to leap onto the profound things. You know, they talk about enlightenment or nirvana or jhanas and these kinds of things, but they don't want to actually look at their own behavioral problems and own ethical choices and so on, which of course the things that are obstructing to them. I had a very nice example of that when I was first staying at Santi Monastery, and one of the first people we had coming to stay with us came out with the unforgettable quote, "The Buddha spoke about liberation, not about washing up." Which for him was more than enough reason to not actually have to bother helping with the washing up. And, of course, one of the problems, of course, he hadn't obviously read the Vinaya, because you find that the Buddha does talk about washing up and various other things like that. And you don't find this kind of attitude at all within the early Buddhist texts. The Buddha himself is very, very, he's not obsessed with details, but, He will take care with all of those things, how you set out the drinking water, how you prepare the rags for washing your feet, and all of these kind of little details. And there's just this sort of sense of evenness and care from the very small things all the way through to the big things. And so this, to me, is one of the great features of Buddhism. We find this simile found in several suttas where it talks about how the rains fall on the mountain tops and then it gathers into little puddles and the puddles overflow and become little creeks and the creeks gather into the streams and the streams flow into the great oceans and streams flow into the great rivers and the rivers flow into the great oceans. And that's, to me, that's a really wonderful way to think about it. Each one of those little drops of rain that's falling on the hilltops, yeah, is gathering into those puddles, and each one of those is eventually going to flow down into the great ocean. So we shouldn't see that there's any kind of dichotomy between these things. So we know that the basic process from ethics to meditation and wisdom, as the course layout has been last workshop, we looked at the ethics. This time we're looking at the meditation. Next time we're looking at wisdom. And these, of course, have multiple layers and multiple areas where they are connected. And these are in very direct ways. Yeah, I mean, the most obvious thing is that if you go and do something bad and then you sit and try to meditate, well, your meditation is going to be rubbish, right? You're going to feel remorseful, you're going to feel upset and so on. You get in an argument with somebody, you try to meditate, it feels terrible. You can see that connection between ethics and meditation. It's not something you have to rely on the suttas to say or on me to say or whatever. It's just something you can see very directly in your own experience. And meditation, of course, leading to wisdom, again, is something that you can see in your own experience. Each time you meditate, you should notice these things, okay? When you meditate, you notice that at the end of the meditation, your mind is more clear. Those things which were confusing, now you can see more clearly. Those problems you had, now some problems will be solved. All of those things which have been worrying us, suddenly they become just a little bit more open, a little bit more transparent. You can see through things better. Okay, so ethics as a basis for meditation is linked in multiple ways. I think we mentioned this in the last workshop, but one of the most obvious ones, we talk about if you look at the five hindrances, sensual desire, obviously, is restraining your senses through keeping the precepts is a very important help for that. Ill will, again, through restraining your speech especially and also not committing violent acts, then this is helping you to overcome ill will. Sloth and torpor, or the tiredness in meditation, laziness in meditation, again, is overcome through performing your duties, being diligent and careful in all the things that you do. The udaccha kukuccha, the restlessness and remorse, is overcome again by keeping your precepts, because breaking your precepts is what leads to remorse and worry in your mind. And the last of the five hindrances, doubt, is overcome again by keeping, if you're very confident in your choices and your ethical conduct, then you won't be doubting and worrying. Did I do the right thing? Should I have done this? And so on and so forth. So all of these things, that's just some simple examples of how the five hindrances, which are the main block to meditation, are protected the five hindrances are overcome and the mind is protected through keeping your precepts. In the suttas, they often talk about the relationship between what they call the power of reflection and the power of cultivation, the patisankhara bala and the bhavana bala. Bhavana bala, isn't it? Yeah, bhavana bala, yeah. And so this is like a kind of pair of things to be developed. And the power of cultivation is essentially the development of meditation, and the power of reflection is the development associated with the development of ethics and your ethical conduct. And so this is something to be reflected on, yeah? There's various, many different kinds of chants and reflections and so on which are given in the suttas for different kinds of conduct. So, for example, the monastics are encouraged to do a reflection on their alms food before eating the meal. So we go patisankha yoniso, reflecting wisely on the alms food. We don't eat the alms food for pleasure and enjoyment and so on, but we eat it for sustaining a body and keeping our practice going. And so this is that kind of by reflecting, then we keep our, preserve our ethical conduct, and then this is then the basis for meditation. Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay, so the question is about this. We find different terminology used in different contexts in talking about the defilements. And so some of them, sometimes we find very similar words like karma chanda in the five hindrances or karma raga in the sanyojanas and other places. Yeah, generally speaking, you don't want to read too much into the particular differences in the terminology. Okay, so these things are basically synonyms, pretty much. Okay, so the main thing we understand the differences between them is from the context and what the meaning of it is within the context, rather than the terminology as such. Sometimes the terminology is, a bit quite specific to a particular case, but usually it's much more to do with understanding the context. So in that particular case, the five hindrances. The five hindrances are associated with meditation and gaining samadhi. Okay, so if you do samadhi, if you overcome the five hindrances, you get into jhanas. Yeah, but that doesn't mean you get enlightened. It just means you get into samadhi. Whereas overcoming the sanyojanas is like a permanent letting go of those defilements, so that you become enlightened essentially. Okay, so it's happening at a deeper level. Right, so it's not the word itself which is the issue, but it's understanding the context. Okay. I don't know, all right? It just happened. One of the, I think, critical and most important points to understand in early Buddhist meditation, and this is, we're going to be talking more about this later on, but this idea of willpower, how does meditation come about, and what's the role of pleasure in meditation? And you will have heard Ajahn Brahm and others of us teaching very often that willpower you don't succeed in meditation by using the power of your will. But by developing happiness in meditation, this is how the mind becomes still. And so I wanted to put this sutta here right up front, basically so that you know that we're not just making this stuff up, okay? This is actually what we're finding in the suttas very directly and very literally. And this is something that's a bit of a kind of a revelation for me when I found this particular sutta and others which are like it. This is not just one place where we find this. This is one particular way of expressing it, but the basic idea is the most common and most standard way of talking about the process of meditation throughout the suttas. All of these kind of categories that we'd find in the later literature, like the Kanika Samadhi and Upachara Samadhi, or momentary and concentration and so on and so forth, and all of these kinds of things, we don't find that in the suttas. Again, the later type way of talking about it is much more objective, whereas with the suttas we find what's talking about much more is a process of pleasure and how pleasure is developed, and it's that pleasure which leads to samadhi. So this is one particular expression of that. It says, for a person endowed with virtue, with sila, there's no need for an act of will. May freedom from remorse arise in thee. It's in the nature of things. It's the dhammata. Okay? That freedom from remorse arises in a person endowed with virtue. Okay? So again, when we go through this, you should just reflect and say, well, is this reasonable? Yeah? That if you break your precepts, you do something harmful, then you feel remorse afterwards. Yeah? If you don't do that, then you don't feel remorse. You don't have to make that feeling come to you. It's just there naturally. Yeah? But of course, freedom from remorse itself isn't anything, right? It's just an absence of something. It's an absence of remorse. But with the proper cultivation, then that just doesn't stay there. It's not just the absence of remorse. If a person is free from remorse, there's no need for an act of will. May joy arise in me. For a joyful person, there's no need for an act of will. May rapture arise in me. It's natural that if you have joy, then you have rapture. So these words that we're using here, joy and rapture and so on, are different words in the Buddhist meditation terminology to talk about stages in the development of pleasure. The joy is a more of a preliminary sense, a sort of everyday feeling of well-being, satisfaction, happiness, contentedness, whereas the one we're translating as rapture is piti, and is more specifically a meditative or spiritual feeling of like a surging feeling of uplift, which you can feel through your whole body and mind. For someone who has rapture, there's no need for an act of will. May my body be serene. For a person serene in body, there's no need for an act of will. May I experience pleasure. It's natural that you'll experience pleasure. If you're experiencing pleasure, there's no need for an act of will. May my mind coalesce as one. So here I'm just experimenting with this as a translating of samadhi. But it basically means if your mind experiences pleasure, you go into samadhi, you go into jhana. For a person whose mind is coalesced as one, there's no need for an act of will. May I know and see things as they actually are. For a person who knows and sees things as they actually are, there's no need for an act of will. May I feel disenchantment and then become dispassionate and then finally find freedom and the knowledge and vision of freedom. Just coming back for a minute to this link here between the mind coming together in samadhi and then knowing and seeing things as they actually are. And again, this is something we find absolutely pervasively throughout the suttas, is that samadhi, stillness, unification, oneness of mind is precisely that which leads to seeing the truth. Okay, that's what leads to insight. That's what leads to deep wisdom. Again, this contrasts with what we've often heard in modern meditation teachings or contemporary 20th century meditation teachings, where there's this kind of contrast between samadhi on the one hand, which just leads to stillness of mind and nothing else, and on the other hand we do vipassana, and then that leads to seeing things as they really are. And this kind of dichotomy is absolutely absent from the early Buddhist teachings on meditation, and in fact, as we see here and as we find constantly repeated dozens and dozens of times, directly contradicts everything that the Buddha said about insight. Insight doesn't come from practicing some special insight meditation method. It comes from samadhi. Yeah. Yep. Okay, so the Pali word for joy here is pamoja. Yeah. Pleasure is sukha, yeah. Different translators. It's really a bit arbitrary, but the main thing is that the pamoja is an everyday sense of happiness. So pamoja is what you feel when you meet your nephew you haven't seen for a while, or you're an old friend and you say, oh, I'm happy to see you. Yeah, it's this kind of ordinary everyday sense of happiness and so on. Whereas the rapture is something is more powerful. Yeah. Yes, Daniel. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, okay, so the question here is, when this says, talk about knowing and seeing things as they actually are, is that talking literally about stream entry, or is that talking about a particular stage of insight? Technically, I would say that the main meaning of it is stream entry. I think it obviously has a broader meaning than that, but in its full sense, knowing and seeing things as they really are, is stream entry. Partly and partly not. Yeah. Yes. And but just to clarify, when it says seeing things, actually that's a bad translation. The word is yathabhuta, which means literally as has come to be or as has been conditioned. So it's not the vision of an eternal state of truth, it's a vision of how things have come to be conditioned in this way. Exactly, yeah, so it's insight into dependent origination. That's a good point. Yeah, virtue is not just keeping precepts, so it's not just non-transgression, but it's also doing things, yeah, positively doing things that are good and kind and helpful and so on. And so this is where the joy comes from. In this sutta, one thing also to be clear in this sutta that when it says that there's no need for an act of will, what it's saying is you don't sort of do this and then say, okay, now I'm going to, you know, make myself feel joy or whatever. But it's not meaning to suggest that this process just happens automatically without you doing anything. I mean, obviously not everybody who keeps their precepts gets enlightened, right? There is more to it involved and you have to still make an effort. And there are other places where the qualities of effort and so on and so forth are also brought in there. So it's not saying that these things just happen without doing anything about them. It's saying that there's a natural process which you're participating in. The energy that you put forth in your meditation and the effort in your meditation is part of that process. So this is how these conditions evolve. But it's not the point is that you don't. It's not by making these things happen. So just to give a little comparison, you know, think about something like planting a seed. You know, so you plant a seed in the garden, and you know, you make an effort there, right? So you prepare the ground and make sure that it's got the right fertilizer, and put the seed in at the right time of the year, and water it, and so on and so forth, and keep the bugs away. So you're making an effort, but it's not just you don't just sort of make it grow, right? So you don't go out there and sort of pull. Adam Brahm has this great story of his first meditation retreat, and that sort of idea that you pull the plant up to make it grow faster, right? So he says you can't. That's not how you do it. You cultivate what you look at. What are the causes, and you cultivate what the causes are, right? And then it happens naturally. So the practical implication of this idea is that when you're meditating, if it's not work, what do you do if it doesn't work, right? What do you do if you're trying to meditate and your mind doesn't become still? And what you find a lot of the time is that what people do then is they say, well, I've got to meditate more. I've got to meditate harder. I've got to do more meditation retreats, right? So you're trying to sort of make it go. Whereas in fact what you should be doing is saying, well, let's come back a few steps. Let's cultivate the soil. Let's do some regular watering, yeah? Let's do some more acts of generosity and kindness. Let's do more service to others. Let's try and understand the Buddha's teachings better. Let's try to look at, well, what are those qualities in my own character or personality that I'm finding obstructive? Do I get angered easily? You know, do I find myself to be, you know, arrogant or something like that? And these qualities that I can develop, and when these qualities are developed, then that will, the meditation will flow easily. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, another good question. This idea of adhitana is a very common one we find in later Buddhism. It means making a resolve or making a vow. And you really don't find that much in the early texts at all. Yes, there's a few places where it talks about it, not in the kind of literal sense, but, you know, the Buddha sort of, you know, someone saying that I'm going to sit here and meditate until my flesh dries up and so on, until I get enlightened. But again, that's something which happens when the causes are ready, right? It's not like a forcing of things, but it's a knowing. There's a wisdom or an insight that knows that the time is right, yeah, yeah. And so then that will kind of work. But it's not like a forcing of the conditions, yes. Yeah? So there's obviously a few stories of people who did that, right? I'm going to sit here and meditate and I'm not going to stop until I get enlightened. But there's a lot more stories of people who did that and then didn't get enlightened, right? So those things only work when the time is really right, yeah. But that became one of the ten paramis, is Adhidhana. And it became a much more important part of the Buddhist tradition later on. Yeah, we don't find it emphasized much at all in the suttas. Yeah. Do I differentiate between willpower and the life continuum? Could you explain that more? Yep. Right. Okay, so the question is about whether the will to live, which is spoken of in European philosophy, is the same as the will that we're talking about here. I mean, I think that we actually find a very exact counterpart for that will to live in the Buddhist philosophy is the word bhavasankhara. Yeah, which essentially, literally, you translate it as the will to live, or ayu sankhara, this kind of word. That, to me, that's a bit more of a fundamental thing. Yes, it's a similar thing, but that's at a more fundamental existential level. Yeah. So just as we were talking before with the question with Ananda about the difference between the different levels of defilements. Yeah. So at this point in the level of samadhi and finding peace of mind, then the will to live is still there, and that still underlies that. And so that is something which is fully understood at the later time in the development of wisdom. So what's being talked about here is more the kind of immediate manifestations, if you like. So if you want, you could consider it as an expression of the will to live, right? Part of that expression of that will to live is we want to control things, don't we? Yeah. Yeah, and we want to be safe. We want to keep our environment under control. We want to have the food that we like. We want to get rid of the people that we don't like, and all of these things. So we're trying to, and this is all part of that expression of the will. And so these are all the things which we have to let go in the meditation. Yeah. In the Upakilesa Sutta, at the end of it, does he use an Adhidhana? Is that one of the ones where I can't remember now. Does he have the Adhidhana thing at the end there? I don't think so. What exactly are you referring to? Uh-huh. Okay, yeah. No, I don't think I don't think it's about Adhidhana. To me, that what he talks about is that has to be pativijja, that has to be understood. So each time that the different defilements arise, then he has to reflect that these have to be understood by me. No. Maybe it's a translation issue. Yeah. Maybe we can come back to that a bit later on and have a look at the details of the translation. I don't have the text with me right now. But yeah, the Pali meaning, correct me if I'm wrong here, is basically when all these different things come at the end, says that basically I have to understand this. You should recognize why this is happening. Understand it, yeah. So it's all about, this is very characteristic in the Buddhist text. It's not about making these resolutions, it's about understanding. Yeah, understanding cause and effect. And so this is the summary of that particular sutta. In this way, dhammas lead on to dhammas. Dhammas bring dhammas to their consummation for the sake of going from the near to the further shore. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Oh, for sure. Oh, absolutely, within one lifetime, yeah. No putting things off, eh? You just, it's like this whole thing. I'm gonna wait till Maitreya Buddha and stuff. It's like, come on. Imagine Maitreya Buddha is just going to be so pissed off with all these people coming to see him. Oh, not again. But you had all the teachings of Gotama right there. And he taught you the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. What do you expect me to do for you? If I was Maitreya, that's what I'd be saying. It's probably why I'm not going to be Maitreya. But anyway. So actually, on an existential level, of course, in the early Buddhism, it sort of recognizes that there's this kind of rebirth process and so on and so forth, right? But in terms of actual the practical teaching, you never find any hint or any indication, I think, anywhere in the suttas that you should practice with the thought of fulfilling this in later lives. I mean, of course, as a realistic thing, sometimes maybe that does happen, right? And there are a few cases where it talks about stories where someone practices something in this life and then they get reborn in such and such a place and then they can continue that, right? So, yeah, it does happen. But there's very few, if any, places where it actually talks about the idea that, you should practice in this life in order that you can continue this practice in a future life. Yeah. You do it, and... What we do find again and again is this phrase "dittheva dhamme," which essentially means in this very life. Yeah, so "dittheva dhamme" is what you realize. The jhanas, for example, are called "ditta dhamma sukavihara," is a pleasant abiding. Translated as "here and now," but basically it means in this very life. Yeah, pleasant abiding in this very life. Of course, yeah. Pure Land sect arose in China in about 7th century AD. Yeah. Sorry? Is there any free will? No, it's extremely expensive. You're just out for a bargain. It kind of is an oxymoron, yeah. I probably best not to get into it right now, but I think the whole question of free will is a misphrased problem, which really arises from kind of a Western dualistic philosophical perspective, and I don't think it really applies if you look at things from a Buddhist point of view. Yeah. Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah. So, again, it's probably going to be too complicated to question to go into here, and we've got quite a bit to cover, so I might leave that one. Maybe for the next session, under the wisdom session, that one might be more appropriate. Yeah. Anyway, let's stop now for a break and do some meditation for the next 10 minutes. So moving along. For the remainder before lunch, what I'd like to talk about is the mindfulness of breathing, anapanasati, and to look briefly at the sequence of 16 steps, but it's not really quite steps actually, but anyway. And one of the reasons for using anapanasati here as an example, and remembering that it is only an example, but it is a uniquely important method of meditation that we find in the suttas. It's one of the ones that's spoken about in most detail and most often. It's very intimately connected with the whole process of what we call satipatthana, or the presence of mindfulness. And it also quite clearly illustrates some of the points that we were making earlier about the integration, the flow of meditation, and the close connectedness between samatha, or tranquility, and vipassana, and insight. Although, bear in mind, even though this is one of the most important meditation contexts in the suttas, it is just one context, one out of many. And that almost everywhere that you look in the suttas, you find different ways of presenting meditation. We find the same patterns throughout, the same concerns, the same sense of balance is there in every presentation. But the details will be a little bit different. So this breathing meditation is arranged in 16, as I said, they usually say 16 steps, but the steps, it's sort of kind of sequential, but it's not necessarily literally sequential. I think some parts of it are straightforwardly linear and other parts are not. But anyway, we call it 16 steps, divided into four, sort of called tetrads, or four groups of four. The first tetrad is long breath, short breath, and then experiencing the whole breath, and then calming the breath. So with the this doesn't mean that you first sit down to breathe, sit down to meditate, and then you think, right, the Buddha said breathing in a long breath, so yeah, long breath, breathing in short breath. Right, so this is not a kind of meditation that it is. Again, it's something which is meant as a reminder and as a guide for you. When you sit down to meditate, what actually happens? You observe what happens. You don't make a resolution, may I breathe in a long breath and breathe out a long breath and so on. You just observe. That's what happens in your meditation. Your mind, when you first sit down, the breath tends to be a bit longer, breathing in and out, and there's a bit more, your body's a bit agitated, the energy's in your body, sort of moving around and so on, and your brain's moving, you're thinking about things, and all of that takes oxygen to fuel it, right? If you want to think about it in purely physical terms, your brain consumes a large amount of oxygen. So as you sit there, everything calms down, settles down, becomes more peaceful. You don't need so much oxygen, and the breath becomes much, much more subtle, gradually softer and softer and softer. And that's a process that you observe through the meditation. And the third stage here, or third step, is experiencing the whole breath. Yeah? So there's a wholeness comes to it. And this is talking about a growing sense of unity in the meditation. And there are different schools of thought in terms of how this is meant to be interpreted. But I think the general idea is that when you first sit down, your mind is more fractured. Everything's going out in different directions, thoughts and perceptions and memories and so on. And the more you sit down, gradually things become more whole, and you're experiencing the breath as a whole thing. So to me, this is the main point of this third stage. And the last one is the calming of the breath. Okay, so you sit down there, and as that goes on, again, it's really just a continuation of the process that we talked about in the first two steps, but as the meditation goes on, everything becomes very, very calm. Now, these first four stages are not particularly esoteric. They're not even particularly difficult. Okay, most people will experience these things if they've meditated for any length of time, certainly if you've done a meditation retreat, or even if you're just sitting meditation at home and you can sit for a short period, you'll experience this to some degree. Once you've sat there for 10 minutes or 20 minutes or half an hour, then you can feel this process starting to happen. You can feel the unfolding, the gradual settling down. So this is important, right? This is showing us that this actually works. This process that the Buddha is describing in the suttas, it's a real thing. It's not just some ancient mythology or something that somebody makes up. It's what really happens. You sit down there, you're mindful of your breathing, and gradually everything starts to become calm. Okay, so this is that first stage of breath meditation. Already, if you practice this, you experience a lot of benefits from that. You know, your body feels more peaceful, you feel less anxious, and so on and so forth. But this is just the beginnings of what breath meditation can actually do. Second tetran, we're moving from the contemplation of the body, the purely physical aspect of the breath, to an experience of feeling, Vedananupassana. And so what we begin to find, and it's quite an extraordinary thing when it happens, especially when it happens to you for the first time, it's kind of like a revelation that you've been sitting there watching your breath, and it's kind of like, oh yeah, that's all right, whatever. Breath's going in, breath's going out, yeah, whatever. And after a while, sometimes you just feel this sense of joy comes into your mind. You feel this uplifting, wondrous sense of joy, and you think, where did that come from? How can I just be feeling a joyful, beautiful emotion simply because I'm sitting here breathing? So this joy we call piti, piti patisangvedi, experiencing the rapture. And this rapture is a sense of uplift, it's a sense of inspiration, it brings a sense of enthusiasm for wanting to practice more. And as that deepens and that experience of joy becomes more mature, then what comes to the fore is what we call sukha, or I've translated here as pleasure, sometimes we translate it as bliss, but the sukha is a much more settled aspect of it, whereas the rapture is kind of uplifting and the pleasure is soothing and calming. So this is a kind of evolution of pleasure, which we've already seen in the previous sutta, where we're talking about not making an act of will, and this joy arises and the pleasure arises and so on. And we're seeing that same pattern here again in the context of breath meditation. The third stage I've just translated as emotion here, but in the Pali is citta sankhara patisangvedi, and the citta sankhara, literally if you translate it very overly literally, is mental activities or something like that. But actually here is explained by the Buddha as meaning the rapture and bliss. It really just means the same thing. In this case, I don't think there's really a sequential purpose to it. It's basically just reiterating the same thing, and then you're calming down these feelings or these emotional responses to the meditation. So when that feeling of joy arises at the beginning, it tends to be more overwhelming, more uplifting. And the longer you sit in meditation, the more calm it becomes and settled. And that same pleasure remains, but it's very, very, very subtle. So this is that process through the contemplation of feelings. And notice what kind of feeling is not mentioned here. Painful feeling, right? Interesting, isn't it? Yeah. And so often when people talk about meditation, they talk about pain. Oh, you have to sit through pain. Pain is your teacher. Let pain be your guru. And so on and so on and so forth. You can learn by pain and so on and so forth. This is masochistic rubbish. Pain is completely unnecessary in meditation. Here, you don't have to experience pain, right? You can learn, you let pleasure be your teacher. Why not? Pleasure is just as real as pain is. Yeah? You can learn from either way. Sure, you're going to experience some pain in your meditation, but don't kind of worship at the altar of pain. Yeah? This is a bizarre ideology which has sort of come into meditation circles. The important feelings in meditation is the experience of pleasure. And it's that experience of pleasure which leads to the tranquility of mind, that leads to samadhi, that leads to seeing the truth, that leads to knowledge and liberation. That's the important feeling, not the painful feeling. You could, if you want to contemplate painful feeling, you can, but it's strictly optional. But pleasure, you're just going to have to develop pleasure. You're going to have to develop more and more of it. You're going to have to develop it throughout your entire body and mind for long, long, long periods of time. Levels of pleasure which are so deep and intense that you never believed it was possible. Okay, so you're just going to have to do that. So just deal with it, all right? No more excuses. I often think this is an excuse, you know, because this whole kind of pain thing, it's easy to experience pain, right? You can just force yourself to sit for a long time in meditation. Oh, I've got lots of pain and I can sit through that and that's really kind of good. Oh, I must have lots of wisdom from it. Anyway, third tetrad. So here we move from the contemplation of feelings to the contemplation of mind, cittanupassana. I mentioned earlier that the word citta in meditation context is usually pretty much a synonym for samadhi, but what it's particularly pointing to is that aspect of the awareness, a purified awareness in the mind. Yeah? So when we're contemplating the mind, here the focus is on the awareness rather than what we are aware of. So the feelings and the body, the first two aspects of anapanasati or satipatthana, these are the things of which we are aware. And now the focus comes to the awareness itself. Actually, when it talks about this, you're contemplating awareness, contemplating it, gladness, abhipamojayang chittang, gladdening the mind, they usually translate it, and then the mind in samadhi and the mind which is free. Actually, most of these are basically just synonyms for the mind in samadhi. So this is a kind of the emergence from the first stages of development, and the mind now is in that state of samadhi itself, which can then be an object of contemplation. Daniel. Yeah, in this kind of case, probably the better word is maybe reflection, or even the word they use in Pali is patuvekana, is reviewing. Yeah, so this is like you reflecting back on the process that's unfolded. No, that word is not specifically used here in the third tetrad. I'm not sure. It's just a word I'm using. Actually, that process of reflection on the process of meditation is really that's what the fourth tetrad is about, the contemplation of dhammas. Specifically, that's what that is. Well, they're not talking in English, generally speaking. All right. So, I don't know, Ajahn Brahmada, do you have any thoughts? I'm not quite sure where the abhipamojayang chittang sort of fits into this, because it seems to be sort of wandered over from the feeling section into the mind section. I don't know if you have any thoughts about specifically how that fits in there. No.
Okay. Oops. I think the way Ajahn Brahm often describes this particular thing, he says that this cittanupassana is about working with the nimittas you're familiar with. Because the place is a place where the body starts to disappear, the senses disappear, and what you have left, basically, is the mind. So it's a kind of nimitta practice. What you're doing there is that you purify the nimitta, you're making the nimitta brighter, and that is the gladdening of the mind, the gladdening of the nimitta, and then that, you know, moves the mind to samadhi, because always gladness that moves to samadhi. The gladder you are, happier you are, you move towards samadhi. That's usually the way I, you know, I would understand that. Yeah.
Finally, we move on to the last tetrad, which is the Dhammanupassana, and the Dhammanupassana is specifically about what we call vipassana, or vipassana, if we understand vipassana as being insight or discernment of the three characteristics of impermanent suffering and not self, anicca, dukkha, anatta, then that's specifically what we're doing here in this fourth tetrad. The first one is anicca anupassi, contemplating impermanence. So yes, the word contemplation is used here, anupassana. Fading away, viraga, either fading away or dispassion. So this is a kind of a lovely image in this word viraga is used both to mean dispassion but also fading away. And the idea behind the fading away is that raga is a dye. Okay, so you dye your clothes with it. And if you're dyeing your clothes with plant dyes, then you have to keep on putting the dye back into it, otherwise the clothes will fade away. And if you keep on washing your clothes again and again without putting dye back into it, gradually that fade away and the cloth will become pure white. So this is this kind of imagery. And then ending of cessation and finally letting go, patinisagga anupassi. So the culmination of the whole practice, patinisagga here, meaning the fulfillment of letting go, meaning, of course, a full awakening or arahantship. So this process of mindfulness of breathing leads from the very first time when you sit meditation and try to watch your breath going in and out, all the way up to full enlightenment. And all the way along that process, we see that it's a natural process. We see that it's kind of signposted here in the different steps of anapanasati, and that those different steps will include aspects of the samatha and the calming, which is mainly the first three tetrads, but also includes that wisdom aspect of insight and vipassana, which we find in the last tetrad. And of course, this is the normal presentation in the suttas, is that vipassana emerges out of samatha. Occasionally we find also that they go together, or that they find you can do them in different sequences and different ways, but the most common way is that the vipassana, at least in the sense of deep insights, deep understandings, will emerge from samadhi. And I mentioned before that these steps of anapanasati are equivalent to the four satipatthanas. Again, this is something which is brought out explicitly in the suttas, in the Anapanasati Sutta and elsewhere, where each of these tetrads is equated with one of the practices of satipatthana, body contemplation, feeling contemplation, mind contemplation, and dhamma contemplation. Right, so in each case, the breathing meditation is satipatthana. And again, this is something which we find often in modern or in 20th century meditation. Notice that when I say this, I have this like hesitation between modern meditation and 20th century meditation, basically because actually I think that these ideas really belong in the 20th century, and we're not in the 20th century anymore, so we should be leaving them behind. This idea that on the one hand you have satipatthana, which is vipassana, and on the other hand you have mindfulness of breathing, which is samatha, and that these are two different kinds of meditation. This is this thing which we find quite commonly taught in 20th century meditation, but of course completely contradictory to what the Buddha is saying in the suttas. Anapanasati is satipatthana, and as a full expression of satipatthana, it includes both the aspects of samatha, calming the mind, and also vipassana, developing discernment and insight. Dania. Uh-huh. Contemplation is just a translation of the Pali word anupassana, which means sustained observation. Okay? Sorry? Because I've never learned to touch type, and that's two words, so that's more than having one word. I don't know. Look, contemplation has become the standard rendering of anupassana. So, we can try to have accurate translations of things, but at the end of the day, we have to watch what the meaning of things is within a context, because a word which has a certain connotation for somebody has a different connotation for other people. In fact, as I mentioned briefly in the introduction, the word contemplation is, I think, the correct word in its traditional meaning, even though today we often think about contemplation as a sense of being a reflective process, right, thinking about something in a reflective manner, but the older meaning of contemplation as used within the Christian mystical traditions in fact means a sense of inspired awareness of the divinity or something like that. So in fact I think is much more similar to what we actually mean by anupassana. Again, being the point that you can't derive the meaning of these things from the vocabulary. You have to look at what's actually being talked about in the context. Yeah? So when we look at the context of the Dhamma Anupassana in the Satipatthana Sutta, specifically what it says is that you're aware, for example, you're aware of when you have the enlightenment factor of mindfulness within you, you know that, you know. When the enlightenment factor of mindfulness is absent, you know how that mindfulness, enlightenment factor of mindfulness comes to arise, yeah? And you know how it can be developed and brought to fulfillment. So you're understanding the hows. That means you're understanding the causality of things. What is the causes and conditions? So this is that reflective process. Yeah? Don't get hung up on words. Look at what the process that's being talked about. Eddie. Is what? Yeah. Pretty much, yeah. Well, again, this is Satipatthana. Anapanasati is Satipatthana. That's right. There are other ways of doing Satipatthana, right? You don't have to do breath meditation to do Satipatthana, right? But this is for the most important way. But any way that you do it, it has to include those basic. The basic qualities and that balance of samatha and vipassana is fundamental to every teaching on Satipatthana that the Buddha gave. Yeah. Uh-huh. Again, you're still bringing in that dichotomy between samatha and mindfulness. Mindfulness is one of the qualities which leads to samatha, leads to tranquility of mind. So this that whole dichotomizing way of thinking is really alien to how the early Buddhist meditations taught. Calm will support your insight. The insight will support your calm. Yeah, both of them work together. And so the problem here is not the particular meditations or the approaches. The problem is the ideology which wants to separate these things. Yeah. And so we have to stop thinking about these things as being separate and like they're in some kind of competition. They're not. They're always working together. Yeah. Samatha vipassana yoganadha. Yeah. Yeah. Sure, why not? It's just not complete yet, that's all. Yeah. I mean, there's always a lot of things happening. This is just describing that process. But I think the key to it, you know, we tend to think in meditation, and especially in breath meditation, again, it's this idea kind of willpower, that if we can kind of make ourselves pay attention to the breath for long enough, then somehow that's going to still our mind, right? Interesting kind of simile that the Buddha uses. He says just like the wind will blow all the leaves before him. You find this in the Anapanasati Samyutta. The wind will blow all the leaves away, in the same way that the breath, when your mindfulness of breathing, will blow all the hindrances out of the mind. Yeah. So it's this idea that the breath has this calming effect. Yeah. So it's not that we're making ourselves pay attention to the breath, and that is what makes our mind calm, but it's that the breath itself has a calming influence on the mind. Yeah. And so if we can just allow that calming influence to take place, yeah, and so we just kind of be mindful and let that gentle rhythm take place, that in itself is soothing. And we're just allowing that natural process to unfold. Yeah? So we're letting the breath calm us down. Yeah? Let the breath calm you down. The breath wants you to be calm. So I think we've reached the end of what I had prepared for this morning's session. So we should probably be breaking now and getting ready for going over the dana. So we will see you all back here at 12:30, I believe. Yeah. And Ajahn Brahmali will be taking you through the afternoon session. Okay, so hopefully see you all back then.